Good evening and welcome to this this debate on globalization, or rather a conversation on globalization at the London School of Economics. My name is Meghnad Desai. I am a professor of economics here and I'm director of the Center for the Study of Global Governance. I'm going to chair this and I hope that you will all cooperate in letting us have a good discussion in a good intellectual atmosphere that the LSE values very much. My present duty is just to introduce Tony Giddens, the director of LSE, who's going to welcome you. Now this, yes, it's all right. You will get used to having stars around, you see, so don't worry. We're all very famous. Among you are the prime ministers and presidents of the future. So, you know, you're as good as we are. Don't worry. This lecture is something we started last year. And it also kicks off the lectures that Tony gives every Wednesday at lunchtime on globalization this term. So this is just a beginning. Here you have four or five lectures, but later on you'll have Tony all to yourself. Tony.
Well, they're not actually every Wednesday. I'm only giving five lectures and they start halfway through the term, in fact, but there'll be notices posted about them. Well, can I add my welcome to everyone here tonight and particularly welcome new students in the LSE. This may very well be the first public event which you've come to at the LSE, and I hope you'll come to many others subsequently. They're all displayed on the screens around the LSE, and there is an LSE events leaflet which gives a program of all the public lectures, or most of the public lectures, that are happening here this term. The debate about globalization is, in my view, the most important debate that's going on in the social sciences today. And as everyone sitting here will know, it is not only an intellectual debate, although it started out that way. It's a debate which brings people out into the streets, from the meetings of the WTO in Seattle, right the way through to the events of Genoa more recently, which have quite often involved significant violence. The reason why the debate is so important, I think, and the reason why I think we have such a big attendance here this evening, is that it's a debate about what shape the 21st century will assume. It's a debate about our collective future and how we might shape it in the current century. Now, those who protest against globalization, and also those who are sitting in their air-conditioned conference rooms who are the subject of those protests, have a particular view of what globalization is. And myself, I think this view is much too narrow, and it does not provide an adequate basis for analyzing and responding to the phenomenon. Most of the protesters who are against globalization, and most of the people from the World Bank, the IMF, and so on, who are in some sense for globalization, mean by it the increasing interdependence of the marketplace. Most of them mean by it the increasing role of financial markets in our lives. Now, these things are undeniably important. If you look at the role of financial markets, for example, you can show massive development over the past 20, 25 years. About two decades ago, only a few million dollars were turned over every year, a few hundred million dollars in global currency markets. By the latest estimate, it's up somewhere near $2 trillion. Turned over every day, an extraordinary intensification of global economic activity. But in my view anyway, and we see how far this is shared by other panelists, globalization is much more profound. The changes going on in our world are by no means solely economic, and I think it's a big mistake to treat globalization as even primarily an economic phenomenon. For me, the driving force of of globalization. The reason why, the prime reason why the world has changed so much over the past 30 or so years is the impact of communication, especially the advance of electronic communication, and that kind of marriage between computerization and satellite technology, which has been so influential in producing a much more interdependent world than ever before. You can even date that. The late 1960s was the first time at which an effective satellite system was set up above the Earth. From that time onwards, instantaneous electronic communication was possible from one side of the world to the other. In its simplest sense, globalization means interdependence. And it's extremely difficult, it'd be impossible, I think, now to deny that we live in a more interdependent world. But as other speakers no doubt will discuss, globalization also means the ending of the Cold War. The ending of the Cold War has simply shifted in really dramatic ways the kind of broader structures of world society. So globalization is not a single phenomenon. It does not have a single origin, and it cannot be responded to in a simple-minded fashion. For me, anyway, to say you're for globalization or against globalization is incoherent. You have to say which aspects of these changes going on in the world you regard as positive and which you regard as negative and destructive. Now, the protesters, in my view, have a great deal to protest about, and their protests must be listened to by others who don't venture into the streets. Among the things the protesters are saying is that there is too much corporate power in the world. The world is driven too much by markets. The world is driven too much by the expansion of Western corporations. And they're saying that the world is a highly unequal place in which one-fifth of the world has become very prosperous while the rest of the world is left in poverty. We must respond to these issues. A good society is not a society where the market invades all aspects of our lives. A good society is not a society where corporate power becomes too predominant. Citizenship rights are not the same as the right to roam the aisles of a supermarket. There is a clear political agenda there. The same is true of inequality. What can you say in 7 minutes? We've only got 7 minutes each. But in my view, it is more or less completely wrong to blame globalization as such for increasing inequalities happening around the world. The question for poorer countries is not to isolate themselves from these wider social and economic changes. No country which has isolated itself from the wider world economy has prospered. Those countries which have tried to, like North Korea or Burma, are among the poorest and most authoritarian countries in the world. So for poorer countries, the question is the conditions of engagement, and certainly we need to counter the lopsided nature of world society, which is surely still much too dominated by Western power and by the influence of an unequal power system. But we only know one way of overcoming mass poverty, and that way is through economic development in which poorer people participate. What we know, I think, one reason why a certain era of globalization, as John Gray might say, has come to an end, is that we know this can't be achieved purely through markets. We know that to include poorer people in processes of economic development, you must have the active hand of government. We should look in our time for a retrieval of the role of democratic government power as involved in successful processes of economic development. In conclusion, brief word about September 11th, since this is obviously in everybody's minds. This debate was planned many months ago. It is a debate about the broader context of those events, not those events specifically themselves. But I feel I must say that, in my view, these events are not a clash of civilizations. They are not a clash between Islam and the West. They're a fight about the principles of the organization of the emerging world system in the global age. On the one hand, the possibility of cosmopolitanism, which David Held will no doubt talk about. A cosmopolitan order is one which admits many values, where you can have many identities, where you can be many things, and you can live along with ambiguity in these relationships. The enemy of cosmopolitanism, in my view, is fundamentalism. Fundamentalism, especially when it merges with a kind of fanaticism, can happen in any area. It is not specifically limited to religion. In my view, you can have religious fundamentalism, certainly, but also ethnic fundamentalism, nationalist fundamentalism. We've seen the damage that these things can do. We stand still on the edge of a new century. We have the chance to create an effective cosmopolitan world order, a project which the 20th century failed to achieve. We should strive to achieve it in this century. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Our next speaker is Professor Fred Halliday. Fred Halliday has an extensive oeuvre of works on Middle East, the Cold War. He recently wrote a book on revolutions being the sixth great power. And his last book was The World in 2000, which was sort of an essay on the emerging forces in a global society today. Fred is a professor of international relations. And he's recently, of course, been very, very much engaged in interpreting, responding, and debating about the nature of the current crisis. Fred Halliday.
Thank you very much, Meghnad. First of all, I'd like to say what a great pleasure it is to take part in this discussion. The issue of globalization is one that touches every discipline taught in this school, and it touches people from all the 150-plus countries from which we have students in this institution. We are an international institution. I'm glad to say I gave my inaugural lecture some years ago on internationalism, but also the problems of internationalism. And picking up on Tony's last point, the challenge we face today is to give substance and reality to that internationalism in the economic field, in the political field, and in the cultural field. I think it was the German poet Schiller who said that one is as much a citizen of one's age as a citizen of one's country. Doesn't mean you're not a citizen of your country, but you are also a citizen of your age. That was true when he said it at the end of the 18th century. It's even more true now. I'd also like to say how much I welcome the contribution which the LSE has made to the debate on globalization. I want to mention two people, one of whom you know, one of whom you may not know. Tony Giddens has pushed this debate forward in all sorts of ways. I don't always agree with him, thank heavens.
Why not?
Because you're wrong. We had one good example. We went on a visit some months ago to Kuwait, and Tony gave lectures on globalization, and he'd handed out beforehand his curriculum vitae, and at the end it said that he was a Tottenham Hotspur supporter. So the first question was, what about the WTO and global trade? But the second question from the Kuwaitis was, what about Tottenham Hotspur? And then he spent most of the rest of the time in Kuwait talking about Arsenal and Newcastle United. And when we go and visit ministers, the ministers say, well, I support one team, Chelsea, but I have three sons, and they all support different teams, and my wife supports another team. And he kept this up for hours and hours. And it was a very nice example of globalization, and if I might say, of English globalization, which carried us forward. Another is a former research student of mine who teaches in the University in Dublin, Pether Kirby. Pether did a PhD on inequality in Ireland in the context of globalization, but he's also a fluent Irish speaker. And they recently had a debate in Ireland on what should the Irish word for globalization be. And I'm glad to say that one of our alumni and one of our students and colleagues has coined the Irish word for globalization, which is now used on the RTE television and radio for this term. So we're making a diverse contribution to this subject. Let me say something, first of all, about September the 11th. This is a very difficult time for everybody. It's a very difficult time because nobody knows what these processes will involve. This is clearly a major blow, a major puncture in the optimism of modernity, in the optimism of your generation, and even the more qualified optimism of our generation, and in the optimism which is associated with the millennium and the period since the end of the Cold War. Nobody knows what's going to happen. If you take something as associated with modernity and optimism and your lives and ours as travel, travel is going to be much more difficult, much more fraught. And to this, I would add two disciplinary points from my own particular perspectives. It may be that international relations has acquired the sobriquet, the title which was once ascribed to economics, of being the dismal science, the social science that talks most about what people might not want to hear about. but the issue of conflict in the world between states and between states and non-state actors, guerrilla groups and so forth, is central to our discipline and sadly a relevant one today. But I also look at this through the lens of the work I and other colleagues do on the Middle East. We have to explain. The motto of the LSE is rerum conoscere causas, to explain, to know the causes of things. And it's our job, and the students, all of you working on the region, to explain how this happened. What are the sources of it? Why did it happen? As well as what are the consequences. I did some years ago, picking up again on what Tony said, write a book called Islam and the Myth of Confrontation. Some days I falter a little bit, but actually I hold to that title. It does take two to have a clash of civilizations, and there are idiots on both sides, demagogues on both sides who do contribute to that, but it is a profoundly false and misleading approach to these questions. But there are two prospective things I want to say, and they pertain directly to globalization. The first is this: if global cooperation in the economic field, in the security field, in the philosophic field cannot confront and face down this challenge, then we're all doomed. Far from this being a discrediting of globalization, the end of globalization, this is the challenge of globalization. We have to show that the coordination of states at the level of security, at the level of the world economy, at the level of the specific diplomatic issues which we confront, can face these questions down and to some extent resolve them. If we look at what has happened in the short term at the level of macroeconomic management by central banks and a fiscal policy, we can see there's been a very, very rapid global response. More money's been pumped into the system than at any other time, and in the interim term, that system will hold. But I think it's also a moment to remind ourselves of the creative potential of globalization. And here, in some ways, I'm even more of an optimist than Tony on some of these issues. If we take the three main themes of globalization, the economic, the political, and the cultural, I do remain firmly of the view that the economic system we have is not necessarily unequal. It is not, to be more precise, necessarily oligarchic. The wealth of the few does not necessarily presuppose the poverty and weakness of the many. And it is possible to change, and there I use the word to reform this system, through conscious government and social action, to spread the benefits which the rich have to the population of the world as a whole. The inequality that we see and rightly protest about is something which is resolvable. It is not inherent in the system, but it will not be removed in the absence of state policy, and that includes redistribution, it includes a global regime for migration, it includes opening the markets of developed countries, and it includes a very much tougher commitment, which we do not see by the populations of developed countries, to the problems of the environment. The level of politics, the goals of democracy within countries and peace between them are, in my view, attainable. They are not myths, and again, they are not necessarily oligarchic. Democracy has many faults. It is by no means sweeping the world. There are a lot of people playing the fake game of democratization, but it is an attainable goal, as is the goal of peace. And again, this is part of the promise of globalization. In the field of culture, I'm not a postmodernist, but I think the postmodernists are right to say we've got away from the idea of modernity or of progress moving towards a single goal. We're not moving towards a cultural world which everybody speaks the same language, Volapük or English or whatever it is, or eats the same food, or wears the same clothes, or may I say has the same kind of university system. Let's have diversity in culture. But that diversity can be within the framework of a set of shared values. I don't believe in dialogues of civilizations or dialogues of faith. I believe in universal principles within which different faiths and civilizations can be criticized and may also discuss. But I think we have a much more diverse and varied view of what an international culture would be. And you only have to look at the LSE with people in 150 countries, to look at what's happening in world music, in world languages, to see we have a diverse internationalist modernity, which is part of the cultural potential of internationalization. One odd little footnote, which I find very reassuring. The best-selling poet, the poet whose works sell most in the United States, is a 13th century poet by the name of Jalal ad-Din Rumi. And he was an internationalist, a mystical internationalist. He said, I'm not a Christian, I'm not a Jew, I'm not a Muslim, I believe in the unity of all mankind. He was born in Afghanistan, in the little town of Balkh, in the year 1207. And it's an amazing fact that his work, his poetry, sells better than William Shakespeare or Robert Frost or W.H. Auden or all the other people in U.S. bookshops today, not because of this crisis, but over recent years, because of this mystical universalism. And I think that reminds us that there is a cultural universalism which predates the universalism of the market. Four quick problems which concern me greatly. Tony's mentioned one: economic inequality, which is getting greater, will not be solved by the market. Also, inequality between genders. I think globalization of the last 10 years has been bad for gender equality worldwide in lots of ways, in employment, in stereotypes, in domestic relations, and this is not something which is adequately recognized. There's a highly gendered character to globalization, which too easily gets swept away in the other analyses. And that inequality breeds something for which I, in that last book of mine, I give the inadequate term global rancor. Now, this is a term I used 2 years ago. You know what it means. Global rancor does not explain the 11th of September. These guys came from a rather rich country. It does explain the response worldwide, the sympathy or the denial or the double standards or the people deserved it argument which you hear. That rancor is there. It won't go away easily. It's something we have to recognize and address. Secondly, security. Security, military security, as well as personal security, underpins globalization. Globalization cannot override it, cannot dispense with it. We knew that before the 11th of September, we know it afterwards. If there's no security of the high seas, you can't have trade. If there's no security in banking, you can't have an international banking system. There's no personal security. If, as is the case, millions of women dare not go out of their houses in this country after dark every night because they're not personally secure, and that's the case in many other countries, what price globalization? So security is the responsibility of states and of international institutions. And here, one of my disagreements with Tony, I think that the highly centralized security system we have these days in the UN is probably the best we can have. I am not in favor of random democratization of the Security Council. I am not in favor of giving more power to talking shops like the General Assembly. International institutions fall into two parts, those who do and those who talk. And it's very important to keep them separate, because otherwise security will not be met. Thirdly, I am perturbed by what I would call the growth in developed countries of an asocial individualism. Individualism is a very good thing. It's a right. It's part of modernity. Individualism is a source of creativity. But an individualism that is not tied to social responsibility, that is not tied to international responsibility, that says, who cares what's going on elsewhere, or who cares about voting, or who cares about educational standards, is corrosive of the whole process of globalization. The last election in this country was fought on two issues, education and health. But I have to say, and here I'm way on the right of the spectrum, unless people take responsibility of their own health, there's no, you can pour all the money into a health system you want, they'll still end up coughing and spluttering or doing whatever they're doing in hospital at the age of 50 or 55, as too many people do. The same for education. You can put all the money you want into an educational system. If people don't do their homework, people don't learn, you won't get anywhere. So, one. Yep. Finally, and we might come back to this, identity politics and communitarianism. I think we have been far too indulgent of people running around with flags, blithering on about holy places and ancestors and tradition and all this stuff. And this is the source of many of the problems in the world. And this is the enemy, not part of globalization. I think we need to have what I would call benign impatience with people who make community and tradition and ancestral this and that a basis of their politics and their conflicts. But I end up on an optimistic note. I think that that as individuals, as members of states, and as supporters of international organizations, as well as members of this university, we can, as Tony said, fulfill the unfulfilled potential of the 20th century. But we've got to then bring in our dear old friend agency. People have got to do things, and they've got to lead, and they've got to have ideas. The matter is open. It's not closed before or after the 11th of September. I remain cautiously optimistic. It won't happen unless we do something. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Fred. Our next speaker is John Gray, who is a professor of European philosophy at the London School of Economics. He has a very, very interesting record. He's written books on Hayek. He has written books on sort of generally in philosophy, on civil liberties, so on. But he clearly, in the globalization debate, he has brought his own very strongly, if I may say, pessimistic perspective on globalization as basically a dystopian experience, if I may call that. So I'll now give the floor to John Gray.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm not sure how pessimistic I've been. It's actually quite difficult to achieve the level of pessimism which events warrant. Like many others, I've fallen behind in this respect. But it is, let me begin by saying what others have said, because I think it's perfectly true that it's a great privilege to take part in this debate here. LSE is the pivot of a worldwide debate on globalization. There's nowhere else in the world where the issues are being debated and contested as deeply and intensively as they are at LSE. And what I want to say just briefly now is what I would have said and before September the 11th. It's not changed in any respect at all. I think it's very important to try and distinguish in our minds between two quite different meanings of globalization, one of which I think was a dystopian experiment and is now practically speaking over, and the other of which is a completely inexorable historical trend. The dystopian experiment was that which emerged only 12 years ago, at the end of the Cold War and in the aftermath of the fall of the wall. It was the experiment of constructing a global free market. In other words, of remodeling the world's economies, incorporating and integrating them into a system which was essentially the Anglo-Saxon free market projected everywhere. And it's not the first time that that system has existed in the world. Something like it existed from the 1870s up to the outbreak of the First World War. So in that sense of globalization, it's not new. Neither is its end new. That too happened in 1914. That's one meaning of globalization, and that I believe is coming to an end. There is another meaning, though, which it's very important that we keep a grip on, and I think that's the meaning to which Tony Giddens referred in his remarks. The deeper meaning of globalization, which I think it makes no sense to be for or against, is that in which it refers to a technologically driven phenomenon going back at least and most obviously to the telegraph in the 1860s and 70s, and in particular to the underwater cables which were laid then and which already by the 1870s enabled news of financial and other developments to be transmitted instantaneously from Europe to America. That development is really an episode or an incident or a phase in worldwide industrialization. In other words, what globalization really is, it seems to me, is that aspect of worldwide industrialization in which technologies which abolish or foreshorten time and distance are central. That's what it really is. And that's not going to stop. Contrary to what some green thinkers would like, it's not going to be reversed. There isn't going to be a relocalization of the economy. There isn't going to be an end, thank God, to the cross-fertilization of cultures, which occurs to the hybridization of identities. None of those things, which are, so to speak, spin-offs of these technologies, are going to end. But I believe the dystopian experiment is pretty well over. Now, if one thinks in this longer trajectory of history about globalization in this way, one will have a number of thoughts which are not pessimistic but I think should be sobering and will enable us to wake up from the light, frivolous, shallow thought that prevailed, it seems to me, in many of the media and in much of politics and even in business in the wake of the fall of the wall. If globalization in the true deep sense of that term is an episode in worldwide industrialization, then one must expect and prepare for and try to mitigate and diminish the kinds of conflicts, upheavals, and indeed wars which went with industrialization in the 20th century. I think it's possible to understand many of the upheavals, many of the conflicts, many of the divisions, and many of the wars even of the 20th century as responses to, often failed or distorted responses to, ongoing globalization. Stalinism was an attempt to industrialize Russia from above. Maoism, in part of its meaning, was something analogous. Even the Nazi regime was an attempt to appropriate modern industrial technologies to a genocidal purpose. So if one looks back at the 20th century, there's no reason to think that worldwide industrialization will by itself, without continuous human agency, without continuous efforts, as Fred Halliday has put it, would be peaceful. There's absolutely no reason to think it would be without revolutions or upheavals or tyrannies or wars. They go with the territory of worldwide industrialization. It's not a reason for resisting worldwide industrialization. It can't be resisted and shouldn't be, because for most people in the world to this day, it represents a better form of life. It represents things like clean water. It represents a longer life. It represents a great improvement in the human lot. But it does not represent peace. It does not represent simple, linear progress. It represents a profound and tremendously unsettling transformation in human affairs, which in the 20th century produced some of the most terrible regimes in human history, and in the 21st century could easily do the same. So that's the first thing I really want to try and emphasize about this, and even to emphasize about the recent events that are all in our minds. Shocking and surprising as they were, if one looks back at the 20th century, there were similar events and larger events of this kind. So what can we actually do? Well, I think there are two things I would like to suggest as for the future, which you as people at a global cosmopolitan institution from practically every culture in the world, and many of you, I think, from more than one culture, many of you, many of us, have mixed hybrid identities. We don't just belong to one way of life as if it could be separated from all others. We belong to several. What can be done? I can think of two things that can be borne in mind. In what I think will be a long, protracted conflict that we're now entering into, it's very important, I think, to prevent the self-fulfilling prophecy of a clash of civilizations. I think the idea of clashing civilizations is, if I may say so, the most poisonously erroneous idea of the last 20 years. But it has the potentiality of turning into something real. If mistakes are made, if errors are made on by any of the major protagonists, it could actually happen. And that would be an unmitigated disaster. So in this sense, I think it's absolutely critical that we prevent that cataclysmic development, which I think is a real risk, particularly if, as I believe, this conflict is only beginning. The second is, I think we should look beyond what's happened to the deeper and longer term challenges. I continue to believe that the deeper, longer term challenges posed by globalization are first and foremost environmental or ecological. That's to say, if we think of globalization as the industrialization of the whole world, we have to also bear in mind that many of the things that global worldwide industrialization require are in short supply, and some of them are irretrievably and irrevocably in short supply. Oil was laid down as fossil fuel by the energy of the sun some billions of years ago. It is in the world today where it is, not because of any human decision, but because of what happened billions of years ago. That and other resources are coming up against rising human expectations, which are entirely legitimate. One of the reasons I believed and still believe that the dystopian experiment of a global free market was bound to break down is that it contains no mechanisms within it which are adequate to deal with the depletion of natural resources. Essentially, all it says is the standard argument, which you will have all heard or will hear many, many times. It's an important argument to hear, but I think it's completely superficial. All it says is that if free markets are allowed to work, then scarce resources will become more expensive, there'll be technological substitution, etc., etc. That may be true in the models developed by social scientists and economists. It's not true in the real world. In the real world, when resources become very quickly more expensive, very quickly more scarce, what happens is war or conflict. And this also aggravates existing conflicts. Conflicts in the Middle East and in Africa now are being aggravated by struggle over water, declining water. They're being aggravated by that. And it's quite obvious, if one thinks of what was the last great war of the 20th century, last big war was the Gulf War. What was that war, at least partly, about? That war was about, partly, access to oil, a radically finite resource, whatever people tell you about that, that it's not finite, that in fact with better technology or better market mechanisms, it can be turned into infinite. I don't think any of that is true. So as we look forward,
scarcity of time,
that's another thing which we can't do anything about. Well, actually he can, but he won't. But let me conclude on a final remark. I think we've proceeded, all of us, we're all involved in this, by looking only at the bright face of globalization. And I've become a bit of a pessimist, or had a reputation for looking at the other face. But I think in only looking at the bright face, it's not that there isn't a bright face, there is. But the bright face itself has flaws, and we're rather in the position of the hero of Oscar Wilde's wonderful fantasy story, The Portrait of Dorian Gray, who hides up in the attic a portrait of himself as he really is. And I think the poverty, the collapse of whole countries, which has happened in Indonesia and in Russia and elsewhere, and the tremendous upheaval that has gone with globalization in the poor world, which is still the majority of the human species, is like that scarred, hideous portrait. And if we continue to avert our eyes from it, then we'll reap something like the 20th century again.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is David Hill. In terms of, you know, how long people have been at LSE, I'm sort of a great grandfather, and he's a baby. He arrived very recently, and he has written a massive tome called Global Transformations, which you'll all have to buy and read, and I'll ask you questions later on about that. But David Hill.
Thank you very much. Well, I'd also like to say how pleased I am to be on this panel, to have the opportunity of talking for 7 minutes to you this evening. When I thought about what I might squash into this time, I thought I'd try and take a tack that would be slightly different to the other speakers. And so I frantically made phone calls over the weekend to find out what they were going to say. As a result of those phone calls, I'm going to focus my remarks to begin with on globalization and democracy, or to put the point slightly differently, we have a very serious problem. And I'm going to start with a rather poignant example. There are certain countries in the world where animals are skinned alive for their furs. The value of a fur pelt, it seems, is higher if the fur is not damaged in any way, for example, by a bullet. In a recent campaign to prevent this practice, UK animal rights groups concluded that they couldn't take the campaign just to the UK government because the UK government couldn't effectively legislate about this matter if the EU didn't do so more broadly. But the EU couldn't do so more broadly because attaching particular animal welfare provisions to the fur trade could constitute a violation of trade rules as laid down by the WTO. The campaign had to be taken to the WTO, and to the best of my knowledge, has there become ineffective. So, what is the proper jurisdiction for handling such issues? Local, national, regional, global? We no longer live, if we ever did, in a world of discrete national communities, which have the power and capacity alone to determine the fate of all those within them. In our world, it's not only the violent exception that links people together across borders, the 11th of September, last night, but the very nature of everyday problems and processes which joins peoples in multiple ways. From migration to the movement of ideas and cultures, let's not just start in the 1870s and 1880s, let's think about the world religions and their impact, extraordinary impact on the world. From AIDS to genetic engineering, from the conditions of financial stability to environmental degradation, the fate and fortunes of us are increasingly intertwined. We live in a world not of national communities of fate, but of overlapping communities of fate. Now, during the period in which the modern nation state was being forged and the territorially bound conception of democracy was consolidated, democracy in states. The idea of a close mesh between geography, political power, democracy, and borders could be taken for granted. But now, globalization raises profound issues concerning the proper scope of politics, regulation, democracy, jurisdiction, and so on. And I want to make four brief points about this, and they get to the heart of what I think is the change in relation between globalization on the one side and the modern nation state on the other. Four points, four disjunctures. First, the idea of a self-determining people, a demos, which shapes its own futures and fate, can no longer, it seems to me, simply be located within the borders of a single nation state. Many of the most fundamental economic, social, environmental forces and processes now lie, in terms of their operation and dynamics, beyond the reach of individual polities. The current concern about animal furs, where I started, or genetic engineering and human cloning, or trade rules and the social conditions of trade rules, are just a few of many cases to the point. Secondly, it can no longer be presupposed that the locus of effective political power is synonymous with national governments and the nation state. Fred's getting uncomfortable now. National states and national governments are now embedded in very complex networks of political, social, and economic power at regional and global levels. As even the Bush administration has discovered as a result of the reaction to its position on Kyoto and in the aftermath of the 11th of September. In other words, political power is increasingly negotiated, shared, brokered among diverse forces from the local to the global. Thirdly, and this is a very important point, the nurturing enhancement of the public good, however any of us want to conceive of it, whether as financial stability, environmental protection, sustainable development, global egalitarianism, increasingly requires coordinated multilateral action to make any of it work, to ensure security, to prevent global recession, to halt money laundering, and so on. The other side of this is, at the same time, the resolution of transboundary issues, such as responsibility for carbon emissions, may often impose significant domestic adjustments. There has been a shift in the operation and dynamics of political power and political authority. This is not to say that the intensification of globalization simply displaces states or disorganizes state power. Rather, it is to say that the context of national politics has been transformed by the diffusion of power and authority and the shift from government to multi-layered governance regionally and globally. Political power, in short, is being reconfigured. Fourth, the very distinction between domestic and foreign affairs is no longer clear-cut. Think of how the great ministries of state were founded in earlier centuries. It was all very simple. Home Office, Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Now most of our ministries cross-cut this distinction in all sorts of and complicated ways. Governments face issues such as the international drugs trade, the use of non-renewable resources, the spread of weapons of mass destruction, the fight against terrorism, global warming, which cannot be meaningfully categorized in these terms: domestic, foreign, internal, external. In fact, in nearly all major areas of policy, the enmeshment of national political communities in regional and global flows involves them in intensive transboundary coordination and regulation. In the context of these complex transformations, not just economic but political, the meaning of accountability in democracy is changing. And it's a puzzle and a serious problem for us and for all of you. The question of who should be accountable for whom and on what basis, what is the proper jurisdiction for handling some of these very fundamental questions, these are puzzling questions. And they do not easily resolve themselves. And the goods to think with we have, early modern political theory from Hobbes to the present day, do not equip us well to address them. The mesh between geography, political power, and democracy is challenged, if not unraveled, by the intensification of regional and global relations. One more minute. One could be very pessimistic about the future of democracy. There are plenty of reasons for pessimism. But there are forces at work which I want to end on a more optimistic reading. Just let me list them and come to a final point. First, we note not just the last 20, 30 years as the era of neoliberal deregulation, but the 20th century as the emergence, however imperfectly, of regional and global institutions, from the UN system to the EU and other regional groupings. Second, we must note the development of international law, from the law of war, the human rights regimes, to the establishment of the ICC, which will happen with or without American support. And third, we note the new regional and global transnational actors contesting the terms of globalization, environmental movements, women's movements, and of course the mixed groupings of the anti-globalizers themselves. These are new voices of an emerging transnational civil society. They are in early stages of development, and there are absolutely no guarantees that they will develop further. But they point in the direction of establishing new ways of holding transnational power systems to account, and they help open up the possibility of cosmopolitan governance or cosmopolitan democracy. Final 30 seconds. This cosmopolitan position is simply that democracy needs to be rethought of as a double-sided process. By this I mean the deepening of democracy and social justice within national communities combined with extension across borders. Democracy for the new millennium must allow people to gain access to, mediate between, and render accountable the social and economic and political processes which cut across and transform their communities. So to return to where I started, the practice of skinning some animals alive. We need new ways of attaching welfare rules, in this case animal welfare rules, to the global trade system. We need new ways of deliberating over the content of these and many other rule systems in diverse democratic fora, from the local to the global. And we need new ways of ensuring that such rules are adequately entrenched and enforced. Improbable, unlikely, unrealistic, but then who thought the Berlin Wall would fall down as part of a Velvet Revolution? Thank you.
Thank you, David. Our final speaker is Mary Caldor, who is part of the Center for Study of Global Governance, where she's a program director. And the program has just published a Global Civil Society Yearbook. It's a very innovative publication that Mary has played a very active part in. All her life, Mary has actively agitated and marched against war, but she's also written very authoritatively on armaments and war, because she's one of those people who has been able to combine action and research in a way that many, many of us would have loved to, but it's either one or the other. Mary Caldor.
Thank you, Meghnad. Well, difficult combining action and research. But let me first say how pleased I am to see so many people. And perhaps when we talk about globalization, the most optimistic thing is that so many people have come to have this discussion, because I actually think having this discussion at this moment is more important than ever. What I'm going to do is to talk about the dark side of globalization. At this very moment, I think we're all overwhelmed by what's called the new war on terrorism. It invades every moment of our lives. It seems to me sometimes it's like a kind of black hole sucking in our everyday activities. And I think it's terribly important that we try to somehow move out of this black hole, think about it, and discuss alternatives. So what I want to do is to talk about my own work on new wars and how it might be relevant to understanding this new war on terrorism. Well, Bush uses the term, this is a new type of war, and my view is that it is new in the sense that it's very different from the kinds of wars between states that we experienced from the end of the 18th century to the middle of the 20th century. It's different from the Second World War or the First World War, even different from the Cold War, in that it's not a classic war between states. On the other hand, there have been new wars, not on the same spectacular scale, in the last decade, what I call new wars, wars like Bosnia, the Middle East, Africa, Central Asia, and I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned from those wars about the current conjecture. So let me very briefly, because I have 7 minutes, say something about those. I mean, I think
only six now.
Only six now. I think the first point I want to make is that these new wars do have to be understood in the context of globalization. And let me say a few things about that. I think the first point is what globalization does to political authority. Tony said it's not globalization per se that creates inequality. But what I do think happens is that globalization erodes the capacity of states both to provide security and to redistribute resources. And if it erodes that capacity in countries like Britain, then the effect in many countries is much more devastating. And people talk about collapsed states, failed states, but I think particularly in states which were formerly closed authoritarian states, the impact of globalization is such that it creates the kinds of problems that we see. It involves an undermining of the structures of the state, a fall in the tax base, an erosion of legitimacy, and eventually a breakdown of the monopoly of legitimate violence. Private armies, paramilitary groups appear. extremist ideologies. And that's, in a way, the breeding ground for the new wars. Second point, the actors in the new wars are transnational networks. They're transnational networks organized around the claim to political power on the basis of some kind of fundamentalism, be it to do with religion or ethnicity, as Tony suggested. And they're networks that can involve private groups, but also bits of state apparatuses. They're not necessarily non-state, but nor are they state. And they're transnational. But I think the key point is that they're about the claim to political power on the basis of labels. They arise as a result of the collapse of earlier emancipatory projects around ideas like socialism or post-colonial nationalism. And they are about trying to gain access to power in the name of a particular religion or nationality and excluding others. It's very different from ideas. Just to give you an example, in the 17th century, there were wars about religion, but they were actually wars about ideas. They were wars about breaking the power of the church or about individuals. These conflicts are not about the character of the religion, although you may want to impose Islamic law or whatever. They're about the claim to the power because you are a Muslim, a Hindu, a Protestant, a Catholic. That's what I mean by these networks of identity. Third point, the aim of the violence is political mobilization. In old-fashioned wars, wars like the Second World War, people were mobilized in order to take part in the military effort, and the aim was a military victory. In these wars, it's exactly the other way around. The aim of the military effort is to mobilize people politically, to create the kind of fear and hatred, the atmosphere of terror, in which people will feel very insecure and more attracted to these extremist causes. The aim is to actually eliminate tolerant people and to create enemies among people of a different ethnicity. So what you see in the new wars is that almost all the violence is directed against civilians. You see very high civilian casualties and also very high population displacement, people being pushed out of their lands because they're a different identity or because they simply represent democratic, multicultural forces. Now, a fourth point about the new wars is that they're not just about political power, they're about economic power as well. That in these situations where the tax base is eroding, where no new wealth is being created, the warring parties finance themselves through a range of activities which are related to violence. Loot and plunder is the most obvious one. And I was very struck, actually, reading The Observer yesterday, a quote from the letter found in Boston car park, which belonged to the hijackers, which said, "If God grants any one of you a slaughter, you should perform it as an offering on behalf of your mother and father, for they are owed by you. If you slaughter, you should plunder those you slaughter, for that is a sanctioned custom of the prophets." So loot and plunder, drug trade, illegal smuggling in cigarettes and alcohol, taxing, humanitarian assistance. All of these are forms of financing which are actually dependent on violence. So if these are the characteristics of these wars, what are the lessons we learn? Well, I think the first lesson is that these are wars that are very, very difficult to contain and very difficult to end. They're very difficult to contain because they spread through refugees and the virus of extremism. They're very difficult to end because every bout of warfare strengthens the extremists and weakens democratic politics. And the extremists have vested interests, both political and economic, as I explained, in the continuation of war. And I think what you find is that in those areas where war has lasted longest, you develop a kind of culture of violence in which children are actually brought up to become martyrs, to become extremists, who are mobilized at an early age. The sort of thing you're seeing in some of the madrasas in Pakistan. What do we learn from these wars about building an alternative? I'm coming to the end now. I think what we learn is that central to building an alternative is reconstruction of legitimate political authority. But that doesn't mean going back to nation states, and that's where we come back to globalization. These emerge out of globalization, they emerge out of the erosion of the state. I think the only alternative is building a global political legitimacy, the kind of cosmopolitan project that both David and Tony were talking about. I could, unfortunately, as I've come to the end, I can't tell you what that involves, but I will give you just the headings. First of all, I think it involves strengthening of the rule of law, both internationally and domestically. And it means that military action, which may have to be taken, has to be taken as a form of law enforcement, not as a form of fighting a war. It means security is essential, but you can't win these wars. All you can do is to provide security in which alternative politics can develop. Secondly, it means support for democratic politics, for civil society. It means the necessity of events like this, where we discuss and debate the causes of conflicts, the problems of globalization. And thirdly, it means a real effort, a genuine effort at global social justice. The key importance of finding ways in which young men can find legitimate ways of earning a living. Many young men in many of these places just do not have any alternative to becoming a criminal or joining a paramilitary group. And I think it's in these areas, even though it's slow and tortuous, that you see where some progress has been made in places like Northern Ireland and the Balkans. Now, some of these things, the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, said
Mary.
In his speech. I'm just at the last sentence. But, of course, it has to be serious. And I think perhaps the most important lesson that we can learn is that we can't shut down global politics, that we can't allow this war on terrorism to stop us from having the kind of discussions that we're having here. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, I'm going to, before I ask audience to ask questions, I'm going to ask for some reactions from the panel itself. But let me say this to the people who are going to ask questions. Your question shall be 2 sentences long. And they will start as a question. Does the panel agree that? I don't want to know your views about globalization. I don't want to know your views about capitalism, socialism, Marx, Hobbes, Engels, anybody. I want questions, because the longer you take to ask a question, you are hurting all the other members of the audience who cannot have their say. So equity demands that questions are short, to the point, and not speeches. I'll shut you up if you do that. Okay. Now, I would like some reactions to this. Who wants to? Which who in the panel? Okay, Tony.
Well, shall I start? I mean, there are so many questions one could raise. I'll just raise one, because I don't really agree with what Mary just said earlier on. And to me, it drives home the importance of what this discussion, I hope, will help everyone understand, that globalization has become a kind of code term for so many changes that you have to be really careful when you either attribute any benefits to it or you blame it for anything. You see states around the world that have become destabilized, and you have problems of coping with security, poverty, redistribution of income. But what held them in place before? Well, it was largely the Cold War. The Cold War was a security system, especially if you lived in the West. But what kind of security system was that? I mean, Mary quite rightly, like many of us, were out in the streets protesting against the ultimate violence that brought that security. And what happened in the world is that many of the areas that Mary's describing as the areas that have been destabilized haven't been destabilized primarily by the effect of global markets in the way Mary seemed to be implying, I think. They've been destabilized by the Cold War. Most of these areas were areas where
the bipolar system was fought out by proxy, and Afghanistan is such an obvious example of this because there's a torturous history of the very groups the Americans supported against the Russians have now come back to haunt the Americans and to some degree all of us. It's true of ex-Yugoslavia, it's true of Africa, which was the kind of cockpit of the Cold War fought by proxy. So we're dealing with a world where the Cold War has disappeared. That has brought us many advantages as well as problems, but you can't simply blame all that on some kind of blanket villain of globalization.
Fred.
To perhaps take up the skeptical position about the anti-globalization movement. The criticisms made of the WTO or of the multinationals or the World Bank and so forth, the European Union, are often valid. But I do think that the Seattle protesters have had too easy a ride from too many people. You ought to ask the question, what is the alternative? What's going to fly here? Not only have they very diverse views as between, you know, green fundamentalists and tree huggers on the one hand and the AFL-CIO on the other, not just between representatives of third world countries who were desperate to get a minimal WTO regime going so that they could at least negotiate about something, but whose concerns were swamped by well-intentioned kids from San Francisco or Canada, wherever, who came and said, we don't want a world trade regime. We've got to find a critique that is tough-minded and real and not give in to every waffly, vague, alternative spiel which we hear. And I think that too much of what comes out of those protesters won't fly, is actually extremely harmful to people in the world. There needs to be a trade regime. There needs to be an international security regime. There needs to be a system for guaranteeing transparency of banks, transparency of loans, transparency of governance. And yes, people should be listened to, but they've got to meet certain criteria. Secondly, as several of the speakers have said, there is an anterior history of protest and denunciation of global capitalism. It was called communism. It did pretty well for itself, but in the end made a terrible mess and failed. Those who want to tear the whole thing down again didn't begin life in 1995 or 2000. They should look back at what came before. And an anarchist is an anarchist, but I don't think the anarchists have a program. So I think both in terms of the tough-mindedness of the proposals and in terms of the history, we shouldn't just say, oh, the old people in the streets are wonderful. I much prefer to talk to a tough-minded economist who's done the work in India or in Africa and is working in the World Bank than to someone out in the street saying, forgive all debt or stop all this WTO imperialism or the rest of it. Sorry, but that's
all right. anyone else in front of Mary? Yeah.
I just want to say a couple of things. First of all, to Tony. I mean, of course, we should be very happy that the Cold War is over, and we should be very happy that old wars are over, because the kind of deaths that we saw in the Second World War is now unimaginable. Something like 100,000 people. What?
We hope.
We hope. No, but I think, well, we hope. But what I'm trying to say is that what I actually said was I didn't attribute new wars to globalization. What I said was it's where you have the impact of globalization on formerly authoritarian closed states. I think it's that combination. It's definitely the heritage of the Cold War, but you can't neglect the impact of a whole, of the opening up to the outside world and the inability of states to adapt to this new world. And that doesn't at all negate that there are positive aspects of globalization too. On this issue of the Seattle and the Genoa protesters, there was a range of protesters. There were some who were fundamentalists, but there were some who were extremely positive, who have put a lot of positive proposals on the global agenda, whether it's debt reduction or Tobin taxes or whatever. And there's an excellent chapter in our New Year book written by Meghnad Desai and Yaya Saeed, which points this out. So, and we'll be having a debate about this issue on Thursday, so I don't all come because it's in the old theatre and we won't have room, but do come if you can.
John.
Just two brief comments on what's been said before. I think the end of the Cold War, in fact I thought this at the time actually when it happened, illustrated the deep wisdom in an old Polish saying, never expect too much from the end of the world. It's a great mistake. Because the end of the world doesn't end, it goes on, the conflicts of history change, and one needs the same kinds of commitment, the same kind of clarity of thought you needed earlier to really understand them and try and have some effective grip on them. Just one slightly skeptical remark about global governance. Transnational institutions are created, funded or not funded, by sovereign states. And when the most powerful sovereign states find them inconvenient, they do their business in other ways, they ignore them. They may need to use them for some purposes to legitimate what they're doing, but the root truth is that transnational institutions have very little effective autonomy of their own and very little legitimacy, partly because they aren't, and in my view can't be, effectively democratic. So I think one of the things which is important now is not to expect too much from them. Now that doesn't mean one has to despair, because contrary to what some people have said so far, I'm actually moderately optimistic about some features which are going ahead. One thing which I think is likely in the coming decades is that the trade regime and the regime that we have for capital flows and other important matters will be less doctrinal, less fundamentalist, if I may put it like that, less an example of market fundamentalism, and more a result of a variety of bargains and pragmatic adjustments. I think we could get out of this conflict a world which is less tidy, more messy, less pleasing to purists, but actually safer, and even in some respects more equitable, because of course it's true that there are large parts of the world which have very little effective bargaining power. But one feature which is going on and is completely inexorable in my view, which distinguishes this phase of globalization from the last one in the 1870s up to the First World War, that one depended upon European colonial power. Now, power and initiative and technology have inexorably already flowed away from the European powers, and they're flowing away from the United States to countries like China and India and other countries in the world. There's no way that the radically unequal bargaining relationships that have existed up till now will survive into the future. So my hope is for a more messy, a partly even deglobalized world, because I think it'll be safer and could even be more equitable. But it won't please people who want to renew any simple universalist project. It'll actually be more pluralistic than that, and for that reason, I think it should be welcomed.
David.
Just very briefly.
And that's a last comment from the panel. Yeah.
Just very briefly, a slightly different tack to John's. I mean, a lot has been said about the mixed views of the globalization protesters, and they are a very mixed range of groups indeed. But I've had two equally depressing experiences encountering discussions and debates about globalization. One is some interviews with anti-globalization protesters in London who had very little to say, either about what globalization is or, B, how it should be replaced. But second, and even more depressing for me, was talking about globalization in the boardrooms of some of the largest multinational companies, where those at the most senior level simply said the issue for them, the problem of globalization was the problem of publicity. The image was wrong. The PR had to be got right. And once the PR was right,
the Labour Party,
there would be no problem. I think both views are equally mistaken and equally problematic. Just one thing. It seems to me, as Tony Giddens has said, the issue is not globalization per se, but its form. We need to reconnect the project of social and economic globalization, as Mary has said, to the rule of law, to democracy, and social justice. It's not the market per se that's the problem. It's the frame of rules in which the market is embedded. We need to reframe it. That is a big challenge, practically and intellectually. That's why we're all at the LSE, because that's the project that we need to pursue.
Thank you. I was really getting worried. We had a debate for nearly an hour and a bit, and nobody had used the word embedded. Now, as you know, you can't proceed in international political economy without embedding somebody or other. I also apologize for the wild outbreak of optimism on the platform. I'll just offer my definition. Optimists are those who think the world will end tomorrow. Pessimists are those who think the bloody mess will carry on. Okay, who's... who's got a short, sharp question? Like why or something? Yeah, gentleman there. Hang on to the mic coming behind you.
May I ask if the panel sees any merit in feeding their views to the European Commission's exercise in governance, poised as it is for the extension to formerly communist countries? And wider than that, how can we make lots more people raise their eyes above the World Cup to what we're talking about?
Okay, for those of you who may not have heard, the question is about what does the panel say about the European Commission's experiment on enlargement or things like that. Who wants to take that up? Okay, let's take several questions. Next question. Gentleman in the red shirt there. I'll come upstairs as well, don't worry.
Yes, I'd like to find out if the rest of the panel agrees with Dr. Heldon that there should be emergence of a transnational civil society, for there's ample amount of evidence that national civil society organizations, for example, are proved to be more efficient.
Thank you. Gentlemen up there.
Could I ask the panel, does globalization represent the end of ideology, as Prime Minister Blair suggested the other day, or are there circumstances in which globalization can be seen itself as an ideology?
Thank you. Somebody called the recent events the end of the end of history. This is the end of the end of ideology. Who wants to?
There's a woman down here.
Thank you.
Well done.
I'd like to know if the panel feels that the recent transnational mobilization of militant Islamic groups is more directly attributable to the negative effects of globalization or to the failures of the governments of the states from which these groups primarily come.
It's a very good essay topic. Now, who wants to take this on? Fred.
Shall I answer the last question?
Yeah.
A lot has been said about the relationship between globalization and the events of 11 September. And in one sentence, I'd say this. I don't think that the inequalities and problems of globalization were a cause. The people who did this came from a relatively rich country, Saudi Arabia. They were relatively well educated. They did not speak on behalf of the oppressed of the world. They spoke on behalf of one particular group only. But I do think that the inequalities of globalization say much about the response. I think we have to take that response seriously, even if we disagree with it. 80% of the population of Brazil said in the survey a week after the events that they thought Brazil should stay neutral in the coming war. The argument that the West deserved it or America deserved it is very widespread in China, in the Middle East, and elsewhere, in some case coupled to various forms of denial of what happened. And therefore, if one has to see why is there this rancor out there, some of it conspiratorial, some of it specific, that is part of a response and analysis of the consequences of the reaction, but not of the cause. Having said that, one has to look at the cause, and I think there are several causes, but I think one is the resistance of many young people in these countries to their own governments, who they see as corrupt. And after all, the main aim, as John Gray said, and as others have said, of fundamentalist movements, is to take power in their own country. That is the goal, and the rest is secondary to that. And that was very clear in the statement made by Mr. Bin Laden yesterday, where he said that target are the rulers, pro-Western rulers of the Middle East. He said it straight out. Secondly, there is the emergence of what, for want of a better word, I've called the greater West Asian crisis. That is, issues which are separate in cause and were in the past relatively discrete from each other have now become linked in one related discourse. So you have Palestine question, Iraq question, Afghanistan question, and then at one end on the west you have all the Balkan stuff, and on the east you have Kashmir. Now these are separate in their causes, but they're seen as combined. I was teaching in the Arab Gulf in the spring, and I was to people who were government officials. They were not poor, they were well traveled, and on all three of these issues there was a very strong sense of them being linked, of the Western policy being wrong. So not that I shared those views, but I heard it, and these were not the street, these were not illiterates, these were people who were educated and traveled and had decent incomes. So that I think that broader coming together of this West Asian crisis on top of resentment of governments, plus the third point, which Mary said is absolutely right, is this cult and culture of violence. And I think perhaps as social scientists, we may have looked at nationalism, we may have looked at war, we have moved away from looking at violence itself. I want to go back and read some people like Eric Fromm, the psychologist who wrote about violence in the 1950s, so I suspect most of his books are out of print. I hope they're not. But I think one has to look at that, the drug of violence itself linked to these two other things. That is the cause.
Yeah. Anybody else want to take any of the questions?
Yeah.
Mary, yeah.
Well, the question, really, your question related to the debate we were having here, is the problem a failure of governance or is it globalization? And I think what both David Held and I were saying was that the framework of governance has come under challenge because of globalization, whether it's because of political interconnectedness or whether it's because of economic interconnectedness. Nevertheless, it seems to me those governing institutions have been much slower to adjust than economic, and there's a real problem of a disjuncture, in a way, between our political institutions and our other institutions, and it's that disjuncture which I think creates enormous problems. It may not be the cause, but it's, as Fred said, it's the cause of rancor. I would say something about the European Commission, if...
Very, very briefly.
You want to distribute the questions between us.
Because also the other question was transnational civil society.
Just one sentence.
One sentence on each. Transnational civil society, of course local and national civil societies are more effective, but nowadays it's through transnational links. I think that was the lesson of the re-emergence of civil society in both Latin America and Eastern Europe in the 1980s. They developed this term, they developed spaces in their society in conjunction with groups elsewhere. And it's precisely because you can no longer maintain a closed society, and precisely because nowadays, as David said, decisions are made at a global level, that civil society has to be transnational.
Okay, thanks.
I won't bother about it. I'll let somebody else
do
enlargement.
I just want to say that I think what Fred said about some of the key issues, the causes of Islamic fundamentalism, are absolutely right. It's hard to see a close connection between the reasons given for the violence and the wider questions of globalization and social justice. But I think there is a connection in the end. And it's this, that unless people are convinced that their legal and pacific ways of addressing their grievances, they will often turn to violence as an alternative. The stagnation in the Middle East, of foreign policy, of the peace efforts and so on, over generations, is one instance of that. And for that, we are all, it seems to me, culpable and all, as it were, need to engage with. That's the first point I would say. So it seems
one
to me there
point.
Is a connection.
One more point.
And on the second, I'm only allowed one more. On the issue is globalization, the end of ideology. No, globalization, I agree with Tony Giddens, is an empty category. It's a spatial category. It's like the local and the national. You can't be for and against it coherently. Globalization is reawakening ideology, as these discussions are showing. It's reawakening the debate about the proper form of these social and economic processes. So it's not the death of politics, it's the reconfiguration of politics.
John.
I do. I just wanted to say two things. One is to agree with that and to say that globalization is, in a sense, used properly, an empty category. It has had ideological uses by politicians, no doubt about that. But we should try and avoid them when we're trying to think clearly. On violence, just one thought. Our experience over the last 30 years, even in this country, is that terrorism, however one wishes to, broad or narrow one wishes to understand that activity, is very, very difficult to eradicate. It has not been eradicated in Northern Ireland. In the broader community of Europe, it's not been eradicated in the Basque Country. It's very difficult to do. The idea that any simple measure, military or otherwise, can actually remove it is one of the illusions we should get rid of. What we should kind of summon the will for is, as it were, a permanent attempt, an ongoing permanent attempt to diminish and mitigate the causes and the sources of this type of activity. But we will never remove it altogether if our experience so far is anything to go by. And that's not a reason for despair, it's a reason for deeper, more realistic, more resolute commitment.
Tony.
Can I just comment on the EU question that was asked? I'm very strongly in favor of the European Union. I'm very strongly in favor of its enlargement towards Eastern Europe. I believe this is central to the future history and peace of Europe. And I think the European Union, debates about the future of the European Union, very, very closely related to all the things that we're talking about.
the EU itself started as largely a Cold War formation, like so many other things. But now you have to see it as a response to globalization, as an attempt to pioneer a form of government above the level of the nation, which still recognizes and defends the integrity of the nation. And I take it that is the core part of what the European project is about and what it's for.
I can only take a couple of questions, and I'll answer them myself. lady over there in red. Final takes too long to answer.
Oh, thank you. Is it possible to have universal standards in animal welfare and environmental protection in a globalized world where so far everything is sacrificed to financial gain?
No. Somebody down here. Gentleman down there.
That's the answer.
Does the panel...
That was a deeper answer. Think about it. Yeah, sorry.
Does the panel believe, as mentioned earlier, that globalization could lead to a large-scale class of civilizations?
I think we've had that, and I think the answers are all over the place. I think one said yes, others said no. And I think since those two have spoken, I will ask Tony Giddens to give his final verdict on clash of civilization. Yes or no?
Well, you have to say no, but if we're going to, are we going to wind up now, I think, because we have to get out lecture theatre sharp at 7:30. I'd just like to say, just to echo the points that Fred made at the beginning, LSE for me is the very prototype of a cosmopolitan community. And it's great that so many people have come to this debate. And I'd like to thank all my colleagues for appearing on the platform with me. And I'd like to thank our very own Don King, LSE's Don King,
Thank you.
Don King.
Thank you very much.